This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. When you clock in at work, are you still you? Or do you put on a different persona, a kind of a mask, just to survive the workday? If you feel very guarded at work, you are not alone. And it turns out how your boss behaves has a lot to do with your answer to that. Brené Brown has spent years researching effective leadership. It's a follow-up to her groundbreaking findings on shame, vulnerability, and wholeheartedness, applying those findings to the world of work. Brown is a research professor at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work. Her new book is called Dare to Lead, Daring Greatly and Rising Strong at Work. And she joins us here in studio. Brené Brown, welcome to 1A.
I'm excited to be here.
So are many of your fans who've already shared some questions with us, and we welcome more of your questions and thoughts about the world of work, bringing empathy and dealing with vulnerability in the workplace. So email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. I read the book, and you say early in the book that it does follow up to a lot of your previous work. I imagine there was a point at which you wanted to take some of the findings you had developed through your research and apply them more practically, especially because you do speak to a lot of business groups across the country around the year.
I do. I spend about, for the past 5 years, I would say I spend 90% of my time in organizations, working with leaders and talking about leadership, innovation, creativity. Recently, talking about AI and machine learning and kind of the consequences of that, the rise of the machine. So, you know, for me, it was probably, 6 or 7 years ago, we had this mission at kind of where I work at our organization of making the world a braver place. And it really struck me that if we don't change the way we work, we can't change the world because we spend too much time at work. And I think everyone listening, at least my experience has been, when that's a bad experience, when that's a toxic environment, when we are in bad relationships at work, our whole lives go just fall apart.
One of the things that you've described in your speeches, I forget which of your TED Talks it was, but you talked about how business groups started to reach out to you and they say they want you to talk about creativity and innovation and the future, but please don't bring up shame, vulnerability, or any of that difficult stuff. And your response to that was,
I can see why you have a problem. You know,
that's it right there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. So if you don't have a culture that is prepared and understands failure, setback, and disappointment, don't ask your people to innovate, because failure is a prerequisite for innovation. It's by debt, you know, you bankrupt innovation on its own terms when you say nothing can fail. You know, and then what happens, and I think we see this a lot today, and I think we see it in civic organizations, government, corporations, faith communities. We see people only doing what they're already good at doing. And we can't, the problems are too big that we face today.
Do you think that we are more like that now than we've been in the past? Or have we kind of always been like this and we're just noticing it differently?
It's a hard question. You know, data-wise, I can't tell you. I haven't done like a longitudinal retrospective on it. But what I can say is I started my research, obviously coincidentally, 6 months before 9/11. And I have absolutely seen us change since then. We are much more fearful. We are in much greater scarcity. So I do think things have changed.
Before we go too deep, we should define two terms in particular, shame and vulnerability.
Yeah.
You developed definitions for these based on your research dealing with people who have dealt with shame, dealt with vulnerability, found wholeheartedness as a way of life. What exactly do you mean by shame?
So shame is the belief or experience that we are so flawed that there's something wrong with us, that something we've done or failed to do makes us unworthy of love and belonging. And the hard thing about shame is there's the thing I call it the shame 1-2-3s. Nobody wants to talk about shame. The more you talk about it, the less you talk about, the more you have it. And it's completely universal. We know from now probably 60 years of research that the only people who don't experience shame, that kind of warm wash that comes over us and makes us feel less than, the only people who have not experienced that are people who have no capacity for connection or empathy. So, you know, your options are limited here to, oh, shame, I know that, or no, I have sociopathic tendencies.
So shame, this sense that there's something about us that makes us unworthy of love, belonging, connection. Sidebar to that, what's the difference between shame and guilt?
So the million-dollar question, with one of the most important answers, I think, probably of my career. Shame, I am bad. Guilt, I did something bad. Shame has no redeeming value. I think if you look evolutionarily, it probably did at one time, but now that we have a more sophisticated understanding of emotion, shame is not helpful. Guilt, I am bad, is when we hold something.
I'm sorry, you mean guilt, I did bad.
Oh, I'm sorry, guilt, I did something bad, yes. So guilt is when we hold something we've done up and think, wow, that's outside of my values. That doesn't not align with who I want to be. And it causes discomfort. It causes psychological discomfort, cognitive dissonance. Here's what I've done, but that's not who I want to be. But what we have found in the research is that psychological discomfort from guilt really fuels behavior change, apologizing, making amends, circling back, cleaning things up. Where shame, we think we want to use it. I mean, especially now, God, it's rampant as a social justice tool. And like, it doesn't work because shame drives denial, rationalizing, and anger. And we do it because it feels good. Someone upsets us, we shame them. But it never leads to meaningful change.
So that's shame. Let's define vulnerability. What do you mean by vulnerability? Particularly because I think there are many definitions, depending on who you ask, of what it means to be vulnerable, whether that just means kind of letting all of your guards down. One of our listeners emailed, I am in a small office, 5 people. My boss is very guarded. My coworker is an oversharer. I'm in the middle saying, help. I just want to work from home. So what exactly do we mean by vulnerability? It's not oversharing and telling everybody everything, right?
Right. No. So vulnerability has a simple definition. It's the emotion we experience during times of uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. It's that feeling that we get when we put ourselves out there and we can't control the outcome. You know, when we've asked thousands of people to define vulnerability for us, and the answers range from the first date after my divorce, sharing a new idea with my boss, giving someone difficult feedback, trying to get pregnant after my 3rd miscarriage, coming out to my parents, sitting with my wife who has stage 4 breast cancer and talking about plans for our 2-year-old and 4-year-old, starting my own business, telling my family members who invested in my business that we failed. You know, vulnerability is the willingness to show up and put yourself out there when you can't control how that's going
to
go.
Now, several of those examples you gave have to do directly with the world of work, sharing an idea, giving feedback, starting a business, saying you failed. The point that I get from your book is that creating space for vulnerability at work is kind of the core of doing anything as a company worth doing, no matter what your company is doing.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I'll tell you this because you'll appreciate this, Joshua, I think. I used to spend, when I would go into these organizations and just like you detailed, they would say, oh my gosh, we really want you to come, but please don't talk about vulnerability. I'm like, well, if I'm coming, I'm talking about vulnerability. So I used to spend like half an hour trying to convince them. And then one day I found myself on a base talking to 100 special forces troops. And I just asked one question. The definition of vulnerability is uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. Can anyone in this room give me a single example of courage that you've seen or witnessed in your life or that you yourself have engaged in that did not require uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure? And there was just dead silence. And finally, a young man raised his hand and said, no, ma'am, 3 tours, there is absolutely no courage without vulnerability.
We're speaking to Brené Brown. Her new book is called Dare to Lead. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well. Oasis emailed, I am a social worker. My boss is a social worker. All of my coworkers are social workers. Our director ensures that we are not only empathetic toward one another, but empathetic with the clients in the community that we serve. We treat others as we should wish to be treated. I know we have to pause in a moment, but that's another term we should define, empathy. What is empathy? Is it this kind of golden rule mentality, or is there a little more to it than that?
There's actually four skill sets that underpin empathy. The good news is it can be taught, but empathy, I think in a nutshell, is feeling with people, not feeling for them. Sympathy is, oh man, bless your heart. Like the Texas version.
Bless your heart.
Bless your heart. Right. Just chills up your spine. Yeah. You poor thing. Feeling for, which really just magnifies shame.
It kind of pushes you away from someone. Like it's almost like saying, I'm glad I'm not where you are.
Yeah, it's like, hey, I see you. It's really bad. It's bad as you think, but I'm over here where that kind of stuff doesn't happen. And then empathy is feeling with someone. It's not taking on their emotions, but it's saying, yeah, me too.
It's kind of, I'm glad you said me too. That's kind of, it feels like it's the power behind that whole movement.
It is, absolutely. If you talk to Tarana Burke,
The creator of the Me Too movement.
The creator of the Me Too movement. It's all about empathy. It's about, you know, and it's so funny because every now and then a word like empathy or authenticity comes in, you know, into the firing line, and researchers are like, I don't think empathy is good after all. Empathy is great because here's the thing. Vulnerability is not vulnerability without boundaries. Empathy is not empathy without boundaries. If you're having a hard time and you're down in that hole, I climb in there, I say I see you, and I'm down there because I want you to know you're not alone. I don't just jump in there and just be miserable with you.
More with our conversation with Brené Brown in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are discussing empathy and vulnerability and how they can help make some of the best employees, bosses, and workplaces. With Brené Brown, her new book is called Dare to Lead. We'd love to hear from you, too. Share what you know about creating empathetic, wholehearted workplaces or what's getting in the way. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Speaking of the world of work, there's been some breaking news this morning about a woman who is choosing a new job and has resigned from her current position. Nikki Haley, America's ambassador to the United Nations, announced her resignation this morning. Haley is formerly the governor of South Carolina, has a somewhat international reputation for being willing to take on her boss from time to time. She told the New York Times she doesn't agree with the president on everything, but says there is a right and wrong way to address that. We'll pick up the phone, call him, or meet with him in person. She'll also be remembered in part for striking back at White House advisor Larry Kudlow, who suggested she might have been confused regarding Russian sanctions. She told Fox News, with all due respect, I don't get confused. She and the president met today at the White House. She lavished praise on him and his family. Here is part of what Ambassador Haley said.
I can't say enough good things about Jared and Ivanka. Jared is such a hidden genius that no one understands. I mean, to redo the NAFTA deal the way he did, what I've done working with him on the Middle East peace plan, it is so unbelievably well done. And Ivanka's been just a great friend, and they do a lot of things behind the scenes that I wish more people knew about, because we're a better country because they're in this administration. I also just have to say, certainly thank you to my family. Michael is a saint, and my two little ones, I adore them, and to Team USUN. You know, they sacrificed a lot. They put a lot of time and energy into it, but they have a lot of heart and really wanted to make America proud. And so with that, I'm not leaving until the end of the year. My goal is that we make sure that everything is in good place and for the next ambassador to come in, but now, I don't have anything set on where I'm going to go. I think that the main thing was I was governor for 6 years, and we dealt with a hurricane, a thousand-year flood, a church shooting, a school shooting. There was a lot. And then to come in and do 2 years of Russia and Iran and North Korea, it's been 8 years of intense time, and I'm a believer in term limits. I think you have to be selfless enough to know when you step aside and allow someone else to do the job. So thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
It's been an honor of a lifetime. And I will say this, for all of you that are going to ask about 2020, no, I'm not running for 2020. I can promise you what I'll be doing is campaigning for this one. So I look forward to supporting the president in the next election.
That is Nikki Haley, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, speaking just a few minutes ago at the White House, announcing that she will be resigning from that post. Back now with our conversation with Brené Brown, and maybe by way of a transition, we should get to an email from Hillary who says, I've noticed more tension since the 2016 election of President Trump. How has that changed the work environment? Have you noticed a difference?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think work, I think this is the whole point. Work is not immune from the larger culture. And I think we have seen, just like we've seen increased polarization in our families, in our neighborhoods, among our friends, it's at work too. And it feels dicier at work. I think that people have to be careful, especially when there's power differentials. And I actually believe it's become a pretty significant source of anxiety at work and home.
Just being able to talk politics or culture or any of these other dividing lines.
Yeah, because everything feels like it's one step away from getting into a cultural debate where we find other people's opinions incomprehensible.
Well, but see, I wonder if that kind of, for people who are not inclined to kind of open up, if that augurs toward keeping the professional and the personal separate, that at work, I just need to be this one person. I need to keep my head down. I need to not make waves. I need to be obedient. I need to be efficient. I need to do the job and get the hell out of there. And the minute that we start talking about empathizing and being vulnerable and being open and compassionate, and that opens the door for me to say something about how I voted or, you know, whether I own a firearm or who I pray to or who I love, that's going to turn into a gigantic wildfire at work. Like, it almost feels like it's an easy way to give yourself ammunition to put on more armor instead of less.
I think you're absolutely right. And here's the hard answer. I've never seen anything meaningful or significant come from mouth shut, head down in my career. That's just not how we make contributions. And so what we have to do is learn how to listen, talk, hear each other, and rumble. I mean, we use the term rumble because it really feels like a rumble. Rumble with the vulnerability of seeing other people as people and being seen as a person. And it's a muscle. It's a foundational skill set. I don't think spending, what do we spend? About a half of our adult lives at work. I don't think spending half of our adult lives in armor is something that most of us are willing to do. I think the psychological, emotional, spiritual, and physical costs are too high, and we're not solving problems. I need you to bring all of you to work. I need the culmination of all of your experiences, all of who you are, to address the problems.
From reading your book and based on the research that fueled the book, a lot of what you describe points to that kind of armor as an indicator of where something is wrong. It's almost like a scar.
Yeah.
You know, a scar is tough because the wound is tender.
Right.
And so if there wasn't something tender, there'd be nothing to protect.
No, that's exactly it. And I think one of the big ideas that came from the book that really, it was actually voided my hypothesis going in.
So voided your hypothesis?
Yeah. It completely just shot it out of the water. And I'm usually pretty good at guessing what I'm going to find, but not in this case. So we asked 150 C-level leaders. It's a lot of data that we use. So interviews with 150 C-level global leaders, 3 years of building a daring leader assessment so people can see where they are. And these were MBA and MBA students at Wharton, Kellogg, Rice University, and then tons of data, evaluation data. So I thought when it was clear that the future of leadership is about courage, we need braver leaders and more courageous cultures, I thought the barrier was going to be fear. But then we went and talked to several daring leaders and said, so you're not afraid very often? And they're like, what? I'm afraid every day. I'm afraid all day long. I was like, so that blew my hypothesis of fear being the greatest barrier to daring leadership. The greatest barrier to daring leadership is armor. It's not the fear. It's how we self-protect when we're in the fear. It's the perfectionism, the pleasing, the defensiveness, the anger, the having to be the knower and get everything right instead of being the learner. So really, you know, and it's interesting what you said about scars and tender places. Not only does armor keep other people from seeing us and us sharing ourselves with other people, armor protects the fear and lets it fester and grow and metastasize. So we need to create work cultures where armor is not rewarded or needed.
We asked some of you to call in and tell us about your workplaces. Here's what two of our listeners left in our inbox. First, let's hear from Adam.
My name is Adam, and I'm calling from Nashville, Tennessee. I'm a paramedic and firefighter, and as such, I definitely feel like I need to do my job perfectly at all times, because there are definitely times when lives and livelihoods are on the line if I don't. On the other hand, I work for a department that's very good about supporting its employees, and my coworkers and I definitely do a good job of trying to share and mitigate the stress of the job.
Adam, thanks very much for calling in and sharing your story with us. Now, contrast Adam's story with Isabel's story. She works in a similarly strict workplace with a rather different take.
I'm a doctor at a big hospital, and it's just really hard to suggest that anyone could feel safe there. You have to watch everything you say and do, and there's so many corporate compliance policies. I would say it's not a safe place to be human at all.
Isabel, we appreciate you sharing your story as well. Brene, it sounds like one might think that being in one of these high-pressure leadership environments would lead to more common experiences, but both of these folks are in places where lives are on the line with wildly different experiences. What's the variable that makes the difference there?
You know what Adam said? That really, it just snagged me. That the leadership there is committed to seeing, taking care of the people. I mean, the thing is, both of them are in kind of real life and death situations. And I work in healthcare a lot because I live in Houston, which is home to the biggest hospital, you know, the biggest medical center in the world. So I'm there a lot. And Adam's got additional pressure because EMTs are the only real public health professionals who do their job in open sight of the public. So it's a lot of stress. It's about the choice of what kind of culture are you going to build? And let me ask you this. Hospitals are increasingly facing culture crisis around empathy and trust and wholeheartedness. But do you want to be in a place where physicians, nurses, administrators are afraid to do the wrong thing, say the wrong thing? That's where accidents happen. It is, because what happens when we can't be human is that we hide mistakes, we don't talk about them, we don't ask for help. And so it is about setting an intention as a culture, and from both top and bottom, building that culture, again, so armor is not rewarded or necessary.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Got a number of comments from several of you about dealing with distrust among your leaders, particularly leaders who have proven themselves to be untrustworthy. Constance is in Silver Spring, Maryland, just outside D.C. Constance emailed, "My most recent boss made a hobby of cruelty. She always picked out one new person as her special target and did everything short of physical assault to make their life miserable, including trashing their reputation with supervisors. One year, I was the target. Everyone knew what was going on. She just likes to be mean, I was told. No one intervened. At the time, I could not afford to quit. I would like to know how you can be yourself at such a workplace."
You can't. You can't, because it's not emotionally or physically, it doesn't sound emotionally or physically safe. But what I would say is that is time limited. I don't know when you stay in a situation like that. And many of us have had to stay in jobs that felt abusive, but you cannot do it long term. And if there's not someone who in a leadership position that you can talk to about this, you know, really freely and say, how do I manage this? How do we hold this person accountable? How can I get some protection from this culture? I think time is short in that position.
Jennifer wrote on our website, the1a.org, there's a lot of getter done in rural communities and families, but the suppressed emotions are one of the reasons that farmers commit suicide at a high rate. If you do not know how to express and accept uncertainty and vulnerability, it can literally kill you. That leads me to a question about regional, even national differences. How have you found that workplace cultures differ across the country, around the world? How do ideas about shame and vulnerability manifest differently depending on where you are?
I'm going to draw an interesting parallel that I think you'll be interested in. It's the same question that I got after I finished the original shame research around religion. Are there denominations that are more shaming? You know, everyone wants to know about the Baptists and the Catholics. You know, that's a big question. They're more shaming than everybody else. Mm-hmm. Here's what's interesting. Here's what we found. There is no denomination that is inherently more shaming. However, there are congregations you can trace, like critical masses of shame as social control, not back to a specific religion, but back to a specific church.
Wow.
Which means it's not the doctrine, but how the doctrine is used by people to gain power. And so what I would say is you can't go to California and find more vulnerable, empathetic people and go to Boston and like more guarded heads down. It's about the leadership in an organization. It's how the leaders model and protect and rehumanize work.
What about parts of the world? I mean, in America, we're an inherently rebellious nation. Like, we are kind of a go your own way, do your own thing kind of people. But great companies have emerged from Japan and Germany
Absolutely.
And all over the world with very different cultural standards that are in some ways much more hierarchical, much more centralized, much less focused on creativity and more focused on compliance.
Yes.
How do you square that?
Well, we were not sure. And then we hosted a training in London and we had 40 people attend representing 40 different nations. And we went around the room and I said, what is the cultural lesson around vulnerability? And every single person had a teaching that was embedded in their hearts and their families and their workplace. Like some of the folks from the UK said, don't get a notion above your station, you know, tight-lipped, you know, stiff upper lip. From Holland, they said, you know, the translation is terrible, but don't stand taller than all the other poppy, the other poppies in the poppy field. Vulnerability is not easy anywhere because all of that armor is protecting the most human part of us, our heart.
Well, and it's also protecting our job. I mean, we've got to be able to pay rent.
Right. Sometimes it's protecting our job, but sometimes it's getting in the way of our job. I mean, I think about in my own role as a leader, and not just as a professor of 20 years, but as a founder and CEO, I would say armor and the lack of grounded confidence has been the primary reason, has been the number one struggle with employees.
I'm sorry, grounded confidence?
So we can't just ask people to take armor off and show up naked. You can't streak through work, right? And the whole disclosure, oversharing stuff, that's not vulnerability. That's something else. But the real ability to show up and lean, you know, the number one problem is people who don't do vulnerability don't do hard conversations. They avoid conflict. They don't talk to people when they're upset. They talk about people behind their backs. So this whole idea that being vulnerable is going to cost us our job, I would argue that not being vulnerable, not being brave will cost you your job. Because when you start having the meeting after the meeting because you're afraid to speak up, that's toxic in the culture. When you start giving people the dirty yes in the meeting, meaning like, oh yeah, Joshua, that sounds like a great idea. Thanks for sharing. And then I get out of the meeting and say, hey, make sure you cut Joshua's funding. I don't want that stuff happening. That isn't not protecting your job. What's protecting your job, again, if you think vulnerability is disclosure, this is confusing. But so let's clear that up. Vulnerability is not disclosure. It's the willingness to stay in a hard conversation when it becomes awkward, uncomfortable. It's the willingness to hold somebody accountable instead of blaming them. It's the ability to reset after failure and disappointment.
I wonder if there are certain kinds of companies, and we can continue this in a moment, but I wonder if there are certain kinds of companies where it's more appropriate than others. One of our listeners tweeted, "Is this person serious? Is this a joke? Keep your opinions out of my place of business or you are fired." Are there some places of business where that's appropriate? We'll get to that in a minute. Stay close. More with Brené Brown in just a moment, but first we'd love your help with the next installment of our special series, The State We're In. We're doing it on Mondays for the next few weeks. The federal government is often deadlocked on passing legislation, but there's a lot happening at the state levels. This Monday, we'll dive into trends on new state healthcare laws, from lowering prescription drug prices to expanding Medicaid to fighting the opioid crisis. What's being debated in your state house on healthcare? Are drug pricing or Medicaid expansion or something similar on the ballot next month? If so, leave us a voicemail. 855-236-1A1A. What do your governors or your local lawmakers want to change about healthcare? And do you feel like these proposals would hurt or help you access the care you or your loved ones may need? Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. Or you can use our app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a radio quality audio file and to keep up to date on future topics. You'll find 1A Vox Pop, VOXPOP, in the App Store. And we'll share some of your stories on Monday when our series, The State We're In, continues on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Brené Brown, author of the new book, Dare to Lead. With regards to armor, Marisol emailed, "Can you address the differences between armor and establishing and maintaining healthy boundaries?"
Yeah, I mean, boundaries are actually a big part of this book because boundaries are incredibly important. We define it very simply as what's okay and what's not okay. And so armor is not about professional management of self. It's not about foregoing boundaries. Armor is about defense. It is, I am going to put the protection of my ego before doing right by this business and the work that we're doing together. I'm going to protect feeling good about myself over moving our work forward.
So there's a difference between, say, armor and image. It's not just kind of the self that you portray to other people to kind of keep bad things in. It's on a deeper level than that.
One of the greatest examples of armor, you know, armored leadership versus daring leadership, is one form of armor we see a lot in folks is the need to be right. That it's that I've got to be the knower and I need to be right. And that's more important to me than being the learner and getting it right.
We got a number of comments from those of you about the way that race plays into workplaces. And Hope emailed, "Can you speak about the ways in which racial power structures in broader society that manifest themselves in the workplace disproportionately impact the contributions of people of color in their work and the extent to which they progress in their careers?" Before you answer, here's one example. Professor Kalpana Shankar tweeted, "As a woman of color, an immigrant, and an academic, I have learned that showing vulnerabilities and even my own resilience can and will be used against me by those in power. Would love to hear Professor Brown talk about overcoming that distrust."
Well, here's one of the biggest findings, I think, is that one of the greatest casualties of trauma is the loss of vulnerability. And when I talk about trauma, I don't just mean a traumatic incident. I mean racism, homophobia, poverty, white supremacy. I mean privilege. Those are everyday traumas, and it is real. The armor that you need to survive those things is real. Which is why if leaders don't work to create a culture where when you're here, you can take that off and be seen, then we can't. I mean, gender is another, you know, I think the kind of Anita Hill criticisms that happen after the Ford testimony, where, you know, Ford was more compelling because she was more vulnerable.
As opposed to Brett Kavanaugh, who was just kind of thundering away?
No,
or more opposed to Anita Hill. Gotcha.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Who was, you know. But absolutely, vulnerability can be used against us. And I think that is in itself a form of systemic racism.
Before we keep going, I would like to talk a little bit about something else you mentioned in your book. You talk about core values, and I don't think any of us has worked at a company that doesn't have some kind of mission statement or vision clarification or posters everywhere saying this is who we're supposed to be, and then it's really worth nothing more than the paper on which it's printed. I've worked at some companies and been to some companies where the value statement was like 15 bullet points long. I'm like, well, what? Where do you even start? You suggest that we should limit our core values to two.
Yeah.
Just two. And there's a long list in the book. I'm trying to find it because there's a lot on the list and I really struggle to narrow down to my two. Why only two?
Well, here's the thing. If you don't operationalize values into observable, measurable behaviors that people can be held accountable for demonstrating, then you just really do have a cat poster. I mean, it really is just it is just really a poster. So
I'm seeing the Lego movie play in my head, that little old cat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've got a 13-year-old son. I know it. operationalize values into behaviors. Fewer than 10% of the organizations we've worked with have actually done that, have taken the time to say, you know what? Assumption of generosity is our value. And here are the behaviors that we will hold each other accountable for engaging in. And so the two is really kind of backing into the data. The men and women who had the capacity to be the most courageous could identify their values. And they had two to three values. And, you know, I have, you know, there's a long list in the book, like we talked about, and there's probably 15 things on there that are important to me.
Altruism, collaboration, curiosity, dignity, diversity, independence, self-discipline, patriotism, vulnerability, wealth, wisdom, future generations, harmony, health, recognition. It's a long, long list.
Yes. So there's probably 15 or 20 things on that list that are super important to me. But when it comes down to it, my two core values for me are faith and courage. And I know they're the core values because it's the place where every other thing on that list is tested. And so we have a companion workbook. It's free. It's downloadable. It's on my website where you can do your own values exercise to figure out what your two are and then operationalize them into behaviors. It has changed completely the way we all work together. We all know each other's values. We understand them. We hold each other accountable for them. And then we have our company values, and that's actually how we assess you every quarter.
Based on the values that you've articulated for yourself.
Like, for example, one of our values is take good care. Take good care of each other, ourselves, and the community we serve. And so one of the things that we measure is I don't talk about people, I talk to people. I mean, you either do it or you don't. And so I think it goes back to something we haven't talked about yet that is a real core finding, which is courage is 100% teachable. It's four skill sets. Each of the skill sets are behavioral and can be taught. It's learning how to rumble with vulnerability, living into your values, which we're talking about right now. It's braving trust, understanding how to talk about trust and breaking it down so we can talk about the anatomy of trust, and then learning how to rise, how to get back up on your feet after a fall or a setback.
Do you need to declare these values? I mean, I would be fascinated to know what you listening right now think my two core values are, because I know what they are. I went through the list over and over, and I finally figured out my two, but I don't know that anyone would guess what my two were based on who I am, the work I do. Like,
can I guess one?
Sure.
Can I try?
Sure.
Okay. Faith.
No. It's not one of my two core ones, but it's encompassed in one of my two core ones, but no, faith.
Are you going to tell us what your two are?
I don't know. Maybe I should. Maybe I shouldn't.
We're talking about vulnerability, Joshua.
I know, but I'm the host. I don't have to do anything. I'm in charge.
Okay. Here we go, people.
Okay, fine. I'll tell you what they are.
Okay.
Freedom and growth. Those are my two values.
And give me an example of a behavior that supports freedom.
Well, for me, being out. Yeah. For one thing, supports freedom. Being a better listener on this program, because if I value the freedom to tell my own story, I have to then extend that to you. And I can't monopolize this discussion on my best days. I will do far less talking and far more listening. Those are two ways that freedom expresses themselves.
So this was an amazing example of how this works. Because, so let me ask you a flip question. You know you're out of alignment with your value of freedom when you're doing what?
I know I'm out of alignment with my value of freedom when I'm going along with the herd, when I'm not speaking as not even an authority, but when I'm not speaking with integrity, when I'm not acting with integrity, because I've been given this phenomenal platform and just my life. Like, I have very few human impediments in my life. Like, I'm a free man. And so for me to act in ways that bind me away from being all of myself, and I'm not saying I've got this unlocked. There's plenty of stuff I'm still working through.
Right.
But those moments when I feel that I'm kind of going along, fitting in, muting myself, shrinking myself down, whether it's professionally or personally or socially, it just feels like a cancer that I can't cut. And it just makes me, it grates on me.
So this is an example. So imagine a workplace where there are collective values from an organization and everyone there can say, here's what I'm acting in alignment with my values and here's what I'm not. Like, going back to that tweet, are you kidding me? Bring your opinion to work and you're fired.
Yeah, is this person serious? Is this a joke? Keep your opinions out of my place of business or you are fired.
So that's interesting because one of the values we have at our workplace is innovation. You don't bring your opinion to the table. You sit back when we're in struggle trying to figure something out and you don't share, you're in trouble at my workplace. So I don't know what kind of business someone's running where they're not interested in the opinions of the people who work there. But what I can say is I hope that we're not dependent on any innovation from that company.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's get to one more voicemail that we got in our inbox from someone who felt like they wanted to maybe be a little more open, but that they had very good and legitimate reasons for armoring up. Listen.
I believe I have to armor up to a certain extent. I was recently diagnosed with bipolar disease or disorder, and it's really thrown me for a loop because prior to this, yeah, I was always going in with a mask on, as I'm also bisexual. In the place where I work, it's a very conservative environment in a very conservative part of the country. So I'd like to know what Ms. Brown thinks about that.
Thanks very much for having the courage to share your story. I have to say I can relate to this caller. I did mention, of course, being out, but like even within that, you know, we know that there are LGBT people, but you may not know like what kind of LGBT person you're dealing with, which float in the pride parade that they will be. And if you knew what float they were on, you had pearls, you would clutch them.
Right.
Like I kind of get this. There are parts of my life, and I think of this person's life, where it feels safe to be unarmored, but there's that one lockbox you have and say, well, this piece of armor, like there's no way I could share that.
So here's what's really important, the important distinction. We share, again, vulnerability is not disclosure. Vulnerability is, I mean, we've interviewed daring leaders, some of the bravest people I've ever seen who disclose very little. But they are willing to show up in hard conversations. They manage uncertainty. They listen. They problem solve. They stay in things when they're uncomfortable and awkward. They give people honest feedback, even if it's hard. Then I've met leaders who share everything, and I wouldn't consider them courageous at all. Vulnerability is not about disclosure. We share with people who've earned the right to hear our story and with whom the relationship can bear the weight of the story. And so I don't think, for the caller who just came in, again, thank you for being brave. I don't think your courage at work is dependent on you disclosing anything about your identity, about your diagnosis. That's not what vulnerability is. That's not what vulnerability is. I would say this. In cultures where we've gone in and done deep work, and there is a huge pressure to conform, to be perfect, to look the same, act the same, and think the same, they have the highest levels of corroded trust and the lowest levels of innovation.
I know we're low on time, but I'm curious to know, what this journey is like for you these days. You've written in the books quite a bit that you are kind of a fellow traveler, that you are not a guru or an expert on this, that you're still kind of working on this yourself. How is it going at this point? Last year when you were on the program, I asked you, how are you doing? And you were like, I'm okay. how is it going now? That sounds very familiar.
Part two. I'm just trying to take it all in and understand it and apply it to my own life. And this book was really, I would say up there with parenting and partnering, leading has been one of the hardest things I've ever done. And I'm an armored person, fifth generation Texan by nature. I'm just an armored person.
You said your family motto should be lock and load.
It is lock and load. Yeah. We have cups. Like, it's awful.
Like customized Tervis tumblers.
Yes, Tervis tumbler. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. No, we're serious. And so I think there's a story in the book that I tell about an intervention with my leadership team with me that said, you're always pushing these deadlines and we fail to meet them because they're unrealistic, but we're afraid to tell you that they're unrealistic when you propose them because you get really intense and you push and push and push harder and we're not going to do it anymore. And this research really taught me to say, okay, let me think about that for a minute, not to get defensive. Let me think about it. And I went home and thought about it for a couple of days. And I was like, I do that not out of ambition, but out of fear and scarcity. And comparison, I look and see what other people are doing and we should be doing that. And why isn't this done already? And it led to a couple of weeks of some of the hardest conversations that I've ever had with my leadership team. But it changed us.
And what a gift that you have a team that's willing to say that to you.
Oh, my God. Brave.
Brené Brown, research professor at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work. Her latest book, Dare to Lead, is out today. Brené, it was great to see you. Thanks for talking to us.
Absolutely.
This show was produced by Avery Kleinman. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit theonea.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.